If you head out for a hike or just to play in the long grass, there's a decent chance you'll return with a hitchhiker this time of year. All three kinds of ticks that live in Iowa are active during this season. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. We'll talk about ticks and other blood-sucking insects. It's also been a big week for the emerald ash borer in the news. We'll find out what that means for you. Then later in the hour, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be here to answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and it's a wonderful time of year to get outside and enjoy the state with one small problem. Your blood is on the menu for a number of insects this time of year. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here to give us some insight into some of the blood suckers out there, namely ticks. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here, and thank you for not calling me a blood sucker.
Well, we'll see how the interview goes.
All right.
We'll see how I introduce you next time. And, I mean, this is the time of year when we've got ticks are very active. There are three different species in the state of Iowa, right?
Yes, at least three that we commonly see. And yes, May is sort of our peak time of year. A lot of that has to do with the fact that most of our ticks spend the winter in the adult stage. And as spring comes, their job is to get out, get around, reproduce. And so they're more active at that time of the year. The other thing that's happening in April and May is that there's lots of moisture on the ground, and ticks are very sensitive to humidity, not just standing water, but they're sensitive to humidity, and the moisture on the ground helps them get out and about. Later in the summer, when the ground turns dry and we get those dry spells during late June, July, and August, tick movement decreases, and so we have fewer of them at that time. So everything's coming together to make this the time of the year when ticks have to get out and do their thing.
Well, and every year, the first time I have a tick on me, I think, what? How can it possibly be a tick so soon? So that explains it, because they are adults already.
They're adults. They turned into the adult stage last year, and then they went into hibernation, usually under tall grass or other protected locations, under leaf debris on the ground, often in areas where there's a good shelter for ticks, and that would mean tall grass, lots of undergrowth, lots of litter on the ground, and so forth. And when that area finally warmed up in the springtime, the ticks came back out of their hibernation, and they were hungry and ready to eat.
Now, ticks are one of those critters with an incredibly bad reputation. And, you know, one of the things that you hear that just makes your skin crawl just to hear the name tick, at least for a lot of us. Let's talk about these different species of ticks and what we actually do need to be concerned about. Because the one we see the most often is the wood tick, right?
Wood tick is the nickname. The official name is American dog tick. And that's the large one. If you have a tick that's anywhere from 3/8 of an inch to 1/2 inch in length, that is the American dog tick or the wood tick, and that's the one that is most common, most abundant, and is the most widespread throughout the state and throughout the region. So American dog tick, you know, all of our ticks tend to be small, brown, soft-bodied arthropods. They have 6 legs at a very early point in their life, but the thing we use to identify ticks from insects and spiders is the presence of the 8 legs, no antennae, and then that leathery body.
All right.
So American dog tick, yes, is the one that we're most likely to see, and the one that's the least likely to have lasting impact on you and your health. Yes, they do take a little bit of blood. Yes, they are maybe attached to you for a long period of time and swell up like a grape, but the long-term consequences are usually not as common with that species of tick as they are with the others, the next one we're going to get to, I suppose.
All right, well, let's talk about the next one, the deer tick.
Deer tick is a nickname again, and it's not a terribly accurate name because the what we call the deer tick is officially known as the black-legged tick. There's a lesson for taxonomists here, and that is don't let medical doctors do tick and insect systematics. When Lyme disease was first diagnosed in the country back in the 70s, the medical community said, oh, look, there's this tick off of deers that we think are doing it, so we will call it the deer tick, only to find out that the professionals had already named that tick the black-legged tick. Official name is black-legged tick, nickname is deer tick, and that's the one that's always in the news because it does carry and vector a spirochete, a bacterial disease that causes Lyme disease. Lyme is still spelled L-Y-M-E after the town of Old Lyme, Connecticut. Has nothing to do with green citrus fruits.
So when you have a tick on you, of course, your first question, or on your child or on your pet, your first question is, what kind of tick is it? How do you tell?
There are lots of good picture references on the internet. And one of the things that you have to have when you're trying to do tick identification is a ruler. You have to be able to measure the tick and very carefully determine its size. On the internet, all ticks on my computer screen look to be about a foot long.
Right, the size of your head.
The size of your head on the computer screen. But you need to read those descriptions and find out the sizes and the lengths. And the one we just talked about, the black-legged tick or the deer tick, is very small. So if you're looking at a half-inch long tick, if you're looking at a tick that is 3/8 of an inch, it is not the black-legged tick. So getting the size right is one of the first steps that we go through. The deer tick is frequently referred to as the size of a sesame seed. So you think about how small that is. We're talking about 1/8 of an inch. So size is an important part of determining which species of tick it is. There are lots of good references on the internet. I'll also put in a plug for our Iowa State University Extension Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Here at Iowa State University, we identify people's weeds, their trees, their plant problems, their insect questions, and we do tick and mushroom identification as part of the clinic. There is a $10 fee for that, but if you're still curious which species of tick it is, those can be mailed to the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic along with the $10 handling fee, and you'll get an answer back telling you which species of tick it is.
All right, and I did recently read in the newspaper, Donald, that Iowa State University is urging you to send them your ticks, and that is not the case, right?
That's not true. Okay. You know, you can't believe everything you hear on the radio, and you can't believe everything you read in the newspaper. We no longer are requesting ticks from people. We had a program back in the 90s and the first part of the 2000s that we were actively trying to determine what ticks were in the state of Iowa and where they were located. And we had grant money to finance that. And so we requested all the ticks we would get, and it was thousands per year. We no longer have that grant money. We no longer have the capability to process large numbers of ticks, but for concerned individuals, we certainly have that service available if you want it. But we don't want your ticks, but we want to help you identify what tick you have.
All right. And if you do get a tick in to identify it, you can tell us what kind of tick it is, but you can't actually screen it to find out if it's carrying Lyme disease, right?
There is no test at Iowa State University to test for the spirochete bacteria within ticks. We cannot do that. Iowa Department of Public Health apparently does not do that. Even the University of Iowa no longer does that. So the best we can tell you, the best advice we can give you, the best information is we can tell you whether it's a tick likely to carry a disease or not. And that's one piece of information. We can also look at a tick and tell you whether it has fed or not. If you find a tick very early in the process and it has not yet fed on you, it did not transmit the bacterium to you. So a tick needs to be attached and feed for a long time in order for the bacteria to be passed from the tick to your body. So we can tell you if it's not the right tick, if it's not been fed, then your chances of disease are very low. If it has been fed, then our advice to you is keep an eye on that tick site where it was attached while it was feeding, And if any rash occurs, if any flu-like symptoms occur, consult your local physician.
All right. Now, I have encountered the American dog tick, and I have encountered the deer tick. I have never encountered the other kind of tick that lives in Iowa. Tell us about that one.
The Lone Star tick is an interesting one that, when I started 35 years ago here in the state of Iowa, that was a southern species that we didn't worry about. And now, Lone Star tick is up into, at least central Iowa and probably throughout most of eastern Iowa. It's another brown tick with eight legs. It's a little more egg-shaped, whereas the deer tick tends to be oval. The Lone Star tick tends to be more egg-shaped, broader at the back. The adult female has a single yellowish-white spot on its back. From that yellow spot on the back of the female tick comes the name Lone Star tick. But Lone Star tick is one that we also find, and it's in that range of about a fourth of an inch, a little larger, and not associated with disease transmission here in the state of Iowa, although there are reports that they may carry the bacteria. It's not yet been confirmed that they can transmit the bacteria, and there's a big difference between finding the bacteria in a tick and finding its ability to transmit it to you. But those were our three ticks, the American dog tick, the Lone Star tick, and the black-legged tick. And since you only have three choices to choose from, identification isn't terribly hard to do, but we're glad to help you with the confirmation when you need it.
All right. And is it easier to do before they've gorged themselves on blood? I mean, they all look the same to me once they're big.
Yes. And it is much easier to identify them. Now, with a microscope, you can turn them over and you can find the little features that we need, like there's a groove that goes crossways on the body of the abdomen. And we can look at the little points that are on the hypostome, the feeding mouth parts of the tick. We can see those under a microscope even after it has fed. But say you wanted to try for a quick diagnosis and you took off a fed tick and took a picture of it with your cell phone and sent that to us, we would have no idea. We could guess based on size, but when they're swollen up, all those features that we need to see are not going to be easy to photograph, and it's not going to be likely that we can make that identification from a photograph. But before they're fed, it's a little easier to do, but once they're fed, yes, all those little features get lost in the swollen blood cell-filled body of the tick.
Now, we have just a second before the break, but Donald, on Monday, we had some advice from our Iowa Department of Public Health saying, don't go in wooded areas, don't go in long grass because of ticks. These are behavior modifications I'm not willing to make. What's your advice?
Stay out of the woods if you can.
No.
But when you have to go out there, there are two different repellents. You can use DEET or you can use Permanone on your shoes and pant legs. Check carefully when you come out of the woods. Take a shower as soon as you can when you come out of the woods and keep looking.
All right. And check your dogs, too.
Check your dogs.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis with us today. It's Horticulture Day. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. I've been talking to Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We've been talking about ticks, but you're welcome to ask him any questions about creepy crawlies. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron is here now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here with us. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And Mark wants to take you to task, Donald.
Okay.
He says he thinks the woods get blamed unfairly for ticks.
Well, actually, oddly enough, Richard and I just had that conversation during the break as well. The wood tick implies the type of habitat where they're going to be most abundant. It's not that the woods causes the tick, but it creates the habitat. Why are there ticks in a certain area? Because the environment is correct, meaning there's lots of moisture, there's lots of tall vegetation, there's lots of debris on the ground to give them good hiding places and protected locations. The second requirement, though, for having a high tick population is lots of little animals. That we are just a temporary food source for the ticks, and we can't keep those populations going in the woods. The rest of the time, the ticks are feeding on chipmunks and squirrels and groundhogs and possums and raccoons and other rabbits, small critters that are in the woods. So it's not the woods itself, it's that type of a habitat, and they can be at the edge of your yard. They're not likely to be in the tall grass, but they can be in the shrubby areas at the end. So if it makes the forester happy, we'll just always call it the American dog tick, and then the dog lovers can complain.
Right. I always pick them up when I go walking next to the creek. That's where I get them, so right. In the long grass next to the creek.
The forester gets them in the grass on the way to the woods or the way out of the woods, but not in the woods.
Not in the woods. And, of course, the other thing we have to remind everybody who grew up with the incorrect and the misconception that ticks are living in trees.
Thank you.
Ticks are never in trees. They are always in the tall grass. They're always on the ground. But when a tick finds you walking through the tall grass and clings onto you, they start climbing upward looking for a place of protection. And for most of us, the only hairy spot they would have to hide is the nape of our neck. So you usually find ticks on you kind of high on your body. It's not because they dropped down from above and that's where they landed. It's because they started at the bottom and crawled up and that's where they stopped. There are no ticks in trees.
The trees thank you.
Yeah.
And so do the foresters.
You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. One more tick-related question before we move on a little bit, and that is, if you wanted to send a tick to you, how do you send a tick?
Dead would be our first preference,
right?
But it doesn't have to be. Any way that it can be preserved and not crushed by the U.S. Postal Service would be our preference. So a padded envelope or a small box, a small bottle. If you're going to send it quickly, you don't have to preserve it. But putting it in a Ziploc bag and putting that in a padded envelope is perfectly acceptable. Add all the information you can, like name and address and how we're supposed to get back in touch with you. Maybe a little bit about where it was found, whether it was found on you or a dog or something like that. And mail that to the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, Ames, Iowa, and we'll get back to you. They don't have to be preserved if they're going to come quickly. If there's some reason you're not going to send it right away, what we suggest is putting it in a small bottle, like an empty pill bottle, and then just cover it with hand sanitizer. Take the hand sanitizer from off the sink and put a couple of pumps in on top of the tick. There's enough alcohol in the hand sanitizer that will function as a preservative until you can mail the tick.
All right, let's get to some other questions. This one's from Larry in Alden. What is the cause of oak tatters? Again, this year, many of my oak bare root seedlings aged 1 to 4 years are showing the effects of oak tatters. I've read that chemicals used for crops may be the cause, but my trees are planted on CRP land, separated from crops by several hundred feet of grassland. Though they look tough, the trees are survivors so far.
I will take this one on, gents. I've been working with this since 1995. And Larry, there is a direct correlation between some of the specific chemicals we're using. One called acetochlor is the group name that we are seeing that it's not a direct drift situation that we think of with Roundup and 2,4-D. There's enough in the air at times that often the whole tree gets exposed. If you look at oak tatters, a lot of times it's not just on one side of the tree. It's often throughout the crown. Sometimes it's maybe on the lower part a little bit more because there's actually a direct correlation between the size of the leaves when they are impacted by this chemical. Usually when those leaves are anywhere from a half inch to maybe an inch, maybe up to 2 inches, they're fairly susceptible to certain chemicals, and what happens is the edge of the leaves actually gets burned, and then about 7 days later, that tissue actually falls off. There's been a research study at Iowa State that has not been published yet that has shown a direct correlation between some of these group of chemicals and that condition. There is a published research paper from University of Illinois, I think in 2004, that makes a direct correlation between a particular group of chemicals. The thing about distance is it doesn't have to be right next to the field. I have a bur oak tree in the middle of Iowa City that has had oak tatters before. It varies from year to year. I actually watched some trees in woodlands for over 8 years. And some of those trees got them every year. Some got it 1 year, maybe not the next. So it really depends on when a lot of spraying is being done and what size those leaves are at that time. And according to our forest health specialist, he sent an email out, T-Vone Feely, just the other day, and he's getting multiple reports across the state already of oak tatters. I've seen a little bit in eastern Iowa. The good news is that condition alone does not kill trees, usually. But if trees become tattered every year, it's almost like defoliation, and that can, over time, cause some stress. That was a long answer.
But Richard, did you have something to add?
Nope. That's basically it.
Well, the entomologist will weigh in and say that tatters comes from the word to tat, which means to make lace. And that's what happens is the leaves become lace-like. Specifically, they become very elongated with just little thin strips of leaf material. What it looks like to a large portion of the general public is, oh, some bug came along and ate away the leaf and left this little strip of leaf material next to the veins. No, there are no insects involved with tatters. It's this chemical reaction and the way the leaf grew. It's not that the leaf material was eaten away. It fell away, and what's left is a little thin strip.
And I actually have pictures year after year after year with the tissue actually hanging as it falls. And so, yeah, there is a direct correlation.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. Amy is on the line in Lisbon. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I was wondering about rabbits in the garden. I have them invading my broccoli right now, and I'm wondering about planting other plants with them to help deter the rabbits. I think I've heard about like marigolds and then like onions and some of the other really smelly plants help deter them, and I'm not sure if that's really true. And if so, how you plant them in the garden to actually be effective.
As far as a plant repelling them, it's not true. They will actually feed on marigolds. Even though they're pungent, they'll actually feed on them. So that's not true. The best way to prevent rabbit damage is by basically fencing, where you put either chicken wire fence, hardware cloth, around those plants that they like to feed on. And typically, if it's at least a foot high, that should be sufficient.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Catherine is on the line next in Anamosa. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
This is about lilacs. It's about time to trim them, and I would like to cut them down by about 3 feet. They're getting tall, and I don't want them as tall. I don't care if they look bad for a year, but I want to get them under control so they don't turn into these great big, tall, high bushes.
Okay. What I'd probably suggest is maybe going out there once they're done blooming, and maybe select maybe 3, 4, 5 of the largest, oldest stems and cut those back to the ground and leave the rest. And that should reduce the height somewhat and also basically keep the plant kind of in a young, vigorous state. And I would probably do that every year or every other year.
Okay, so you're saying that I can't cut the tops off or just cut them down?
Well,
like you would a hedge or something like that.
Yeah, you can give them a haircut, but I think they would perform better if they were pruned a little bit more selectively.
Okay. And also with suckers, if I put Roundup on the suckers, am I going to kill the whole lilac?
You very well could, yes. So that's a no-no.
Okay. That's what I need to know then. Thank you so
All
much.
All right. Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Catherine. We have room for your call now, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email from Michael in Des Moines. My two Boy Scouts are working on their gardening merit badge, diligently caring for their plant starts over the last couple of months. On beautiful Sunday afternoon, tomatoes, cucumbers, and watermelon went into the garden. Then came consecutive cold nights, and the plants wilted and lost their leaves. The boys have used 2-liter soda bottles to create little greenhouses for tomatoes and covered others with straw. Is there anything else that can be done to possibly save some of the transplants?
I would probably take off the soda bottles and just leave them exposed. At this point, I think just good care if it's not raining, water them periodically. And I think they should recover if they're not totally dead. I mean, they may have lost some leaves. They may not look good. But if they're still alive, given a chance, I think they'll recover.
Okay. He also is concerned about, they do have some of the other plant starts that haven't been planted yet. So he's concerned about giving them a better transition.
Yeah. Make sure that if they started these inside, that they bring them outside and initially put them in complete shade and leave them there for maybe a day or two, and then gradually expose the plants to periods of sunlight. And after about 6 or 7 days, they should be ready to go.
All right. Here's another email. This one's for you, Donald, from Larissa in Ames. A couple of questions. How should you remove a tick if it's latched onto you or your dog? Is there any way to get the tick to let go? She also says she's heard that vinegar will repel them if she sprays her dog with vinegar before going into the woods. Should that keep ticks away?
Wow. I'm not sure I want to assault my dog's senses by spraying him with vinegar. Well, tick removal, it's always been simple. It's always been the same answer. The sharpest tweezers or forceps that you have, you grip at the point of attachment as low on the tick as you can, and you pull straight back. You just pull straight out. As far as making them let go, there is nothing underlined, bold, emphasized, italicized, there is nothing that will make a tick let go instantly, in part because the tick is both hooked and cemented into your skin, so it can stay there for the 24 hours, during which time it's going to do the regurgitative feeding that allows it to swell up with your red blood cells. So nothing is going to make them let go early. Things like Vaseline have no effect. Fingernail polish has no effect. I remember my daughter's pediatrician thanking me for saying, never, ever use a lighted cigarette to make a tick back off, because his experience was that he treated more children for cigarette burns than he treated for tick bites. So all of those folk tales about, oh, get the tick off quickly by using one of these, all of those are wrong. Sharp tweezers, close to the skin, pull straight back. Yes, it's going to hurt a little bit. Yes, it's going to tear a little bit, but that's the way it's done. And the CDC, Center for Disease Control, has great pictures on their website of how to do this. As far as repellents, vinegar gets a lot of credit for a lot of things that just seem
miraculous.
And to quote Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and we don't find that with vinegar as a repellent. So if making your dog smell like a tossed salad appeals to you, there's probably no harm in it, but it's not going to keep the ticks off.
All right. there are the chemicals you can use to spot your dogs. That keep the ticks from biting your dogs, right?
Well, yes and no. Yes, see your veterinarian. There are several different insecticides that we use for tick and flea control on our pets. These are topically applied. You part the skin, you part the hair, you put these liquids on the skin. The liquids then absorb into the skin, and the insecticide is in the dog's blood system. That implies a little bit of repellency, but it also kills ticks and fleas as they're feeding on the animal's blood. So those systemic insecticides that we apply to the dogs are a good way to prevent the ticks from attaching, feeding, and staying attached.
All right, we're going to go to the phones now. Betty is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I just have a quick question, and I know I should have done this a month and a half ago, but I'm looking at all these suckers on my crabapple tree, and I would like to trim them off before the yard waste recycling truck comes.
I would go ahead and do it. Cut them back as far as you can. Try to don't just nip them off. Try to cut them back to where they're connected, and if they're a little below, try to cut low. But, yeah, you can cut them now.
Do I need to put any solution on the cut?
No.
Great. Okay, thanks. Bye, you guys.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Betty. Next up, we've got David in Iowa City. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a question about something nipping our flower buds off our potted geranium plants on the front stoop of our house. It's a concrete stoop right by our front door. And the other morning went out, several of the flower stems were just bitten off. The flower heads were lying there. Didn't appear that the plant had been heat. Something bit those off. Would those be rabbits? And why would they do that and not eat the plant?
Well, it could be rabbits. They will do that, where they will chop off or chew off a stem and just leave it lying on the ground. I once saw several tulips that had been cut off, and there was the stem and the flower laying on the ground, and they simply did not eat the rest of it. They just chewed it off. So I'm not sure why they do it, but I would suspect rabbits.
Okay, well, that's kind of what we suspected. We were just curious as to why they would leave it and not eat it, just bite it off.
I'm not sure.
I think it's boredom. That your rabbits need more entertainment.
Donald Lewis, also rabbit psychologist.
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a few minutes. With me today, Iowa State University Extension entomologist and rabbit psychologist Donald Lewis. We also have Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. You can join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions. We've got Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis here today, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. So really, any question you have, we can probably cover it. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. James is up next in Nevada. Hi, James.
Hey.
Hi, what's your question?
I got this. I live on kind of a lane where there's nice old trees in front of all the houses, and I live on a very small property, so I just have one tree in front of my house. And I've listened to Horticulture Day long enough to hear Richard say, you know, it's drunk, or it's your tree's drunk, kill it. You know, it's like 40% of it looks like it's been hit by lightning. It's going to die or fall down in the next, I don't know, probably 5 years. But there's like maybe approximately 15 feet between that tree and the next property where I could plant another tree. And I was just wondering if it would be possible to plant a younger tree sort of under that tree. It's a maple. And like get it going while that tree, before that tree completely dies.
What one thing you need to consider, James, is if you place that tree 15 feet away, if it's a tree that's going to get decent size, what impact will that have on the property lines? Do you have enough room for a tree to expand to be able to reach that? If it gets, you know, half a day's sun, you could get another tree established. It may tilt a little bit on you depending on how much shade it does get. As long as it's not under complete shade, there's a number of species you could plant. But again, I would think about how much space do you have so you don't compete with the neighbor's property.
Fair enough. What species would you suggest?
Well, again, depending on how much space, if you don't have a lot of space and you want something more upright that's not going to get huge, I would think of something like Japanese tree lilac. If you can have a bigger tree, honey locust is good, red oak is good. Another option is something, depending on what kind of maple you have, is some type of like sugar maple, which is fairly shade tolerant. The caveat to that is we talk about, you know, problems and stuff. There is a new potential insect problem on maple called Asian longhorn beetle at some point. Could be kind of like what we're dealing with ash. That species really likes maple, so you may want to deter or get away from that. But there's a number of choices, or even if it doesn't have to be huge, there's a number of different crab apples. I'll do that for Jeff Isles, that have upright growth. Again, it kind of depends on how much actual space you have and kind of what your soil conditions are too.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, James. 866-780-9100. We've got Joe up next in Iowa City. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I have a question about poison ivy. I have some fir trees that are sort of in a line about 4 feet apart. And there's poison ivy all over with runners up the trees, you know, along the ground. I've cleaned up quite a bit of it. But there's so many runners and everything that I was wondering if I can spray anything there without impacting the fir trees.
My first thought would be you could use Roundup. But if you use Roundup, you should not get it on the evergreen trees themselves. So if you can do that, if it's laying on the ground, you can spray them on the ground, but don't spray the actual trees themselves. If that doesn't work, possibly cutting off the stems near the ground and then applying Roundup directly to those cut surfaces.
Okay. So that makes sense. I can do that. I have another quick question about, is it too late to trim my cherry and apple trees?
Well, at this point, I would not. The best time basically would be March, early April, before they begin to leaf out. If you have some branches that really have to come out for some reason that are living branches, maybe do so in midsummer, but keep it to a minimum.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Brad in Des Moines. Hi, Brad.
Hi. So I have a question. My family likes to... we want to go start hunting for morel mushrooms in the forest, and I just don't know the best time or season to do that in.
When they're out of the ground. Sorry. Actually,
anytime?
Actually, Brad, we're kind of in the middle, or even depending on where you're located, maybe towards the end in some locations. I think as you go further north, people will still be hunting mushrooms. Around here in Iowa City, just in this last week, people are still finding some of the larger yellows. Obviously, if you go further south, things are probably pretty much slowing down. The thing I would tell you, Brad, is morel mushrooms can be anywhere, not just in the woods. A lot of times in certain grass patches or around pine trees, different apple orchards, you name it. But in the woods in general, one thing I always kind of encourage people to do is if they're starting to learn are starting to kind of learn their woods as far as mushrooms, I would focus on dead elms. And those are elms that died the year before. When that bark is tight, usually that first year, if they are going to produce mushrooms in that area, it tends to be better that first year, sometimes into the second. But if a lot of the bark is off and that bark is hanging, I tend not to look around those trees as much. Now, a lot of times you might just have an area for different reasons because of the soil and other things. There's not always elms there. It may just be a good mushroom area. Generally in the spring, this year I started finding little grays on April 19th. And a lot of times if we go, usually I kind of use Mother's Day as my, if I'm still hunting in during Mother's Day, things have been pretty good or it's a little late. Every year it's going to be a little different, but it's usually about a 4-week period in your area, depending where you're located. Also with me, I'll give you one other, when my lilac in my backyard starts to bloom, when my crabapple blooms first, I start going. And then when my lilac starts to bloom, the purple, I'm usually into them pretty heavy. And I've been using that for 12 years, Brad, and it works pretty good.
All right. So since he's in Des Moines, probably things are really close to the end there.
Well, Richard could probably tell us what he's hearing in the Ames area and stuff, and there might be some correlation between that and Des Moines.
We might be a few days behind Iowa City, but just a few days.
So he's probably close to being, if not at the end, towards the end. If he wants to look, I would look now on north and east hillsides, especially north hillsides and slopes where maybe it's a little cooler. A lot of times you'll find some of those late yellows on those northern hillsides. But when you first start, I would start on the west and the south sides of the hills because that tends to warm up first, and that's where we tend to find them first.
All right, Brad, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we'll go to Sandra in Knoxville. Hello, Sandra.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was wondering, so many people are using weed and seed on their yards for dandelions and so on. What is the effect of the weed portion of that fertilizer on earthworms and thus the birds?
Basically, very little. The earthworms will always be there, so that's not a great concern. So
there are other pesticides, specifically some insecticides and one or two fungicides, that do decrease earthworm survivorship and earthworm populations, but the herbicides generally do not. So in that sense, we're lucky. In fact, the reverse of your question, Sandra, is sometimes people think they have too many earthworms and they ask, how can I control them? And the answer is, we don't have a chemical for earthworm control. All those that used to be highly toxic to earthworms disappeared off the market back in the 1980s. So low impact from all of our pesticides, but especially the herbicides.
All right. Let's go next to GT in Battle Creek. Hello, GT.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Yes, Charity. My question has to do with asparagus. I have a neighbor who is wanting to plant asparagus, mm-hmm. and he asked me for the names of the best asparagus for our heavy Iowa soil. And I told him I would check with you brilliant people, and you'd tell me.
Okay, brilliant people. Okay, good. I would go with one of the Jersey hybrids. It could be Jersey Giant, Jersey Supreme, any of the Jersey hybrids. These come out of Rutgers University. They're essentially male hybrids, and so they're more productive than the older varieties. So any of the Jersey hybrids would be good.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, GT. And Richard, can you explain to me why our volunteer asparagus in our ditch does so much better than the asparagus in our garden?
It's part psychological, I think. But the newer hybrids actually are very, very productive because typically you have both male and female plants, and the females produce the small little red fruits. That weakens them a little bit, so they're not as productive. The males tend to be more productive. They don't produce the fruit. They're also longer live, so they are more productive.
Do I need one of each, though, to produce asparagus?
Nope.
You don't. That's good.
You can have all males. That's fine.
All right. Frank is on the line in Fairfield next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I have some trees that I planted this spring, and my neighbor burnt his field next to the trees, and he was careful to mow around the trees. But so the fire wouldn't get there, but the heat burned all the leaves off of them. So is there anything that I can do to help those trees survive there? The branches are still limber. They're not, you know, brittle. So it indicates the trees are still alive, but there's no leaves.
I would scrape them too, Frank, to see if there's some green with your thumbnail. And then I guess what I would do is, we've been getting some decent moisture lately, but if we get dry, just make sure they stay, they get good moisture and some additional watering if needed. That's no fertilizer, nothing like that. All I would do is look at watering. That way, if they can break some new buds, then they would have that moisture to keep going.
How long does that take?
I would say probably he should know within the next month if they're going to make it or not. It could take a number of weeks if they were severely stressed. They could still relief. Obviously, keep checking them to see if they're bendable and they have green. If they still have green, I would give them some time to see what happens. They can really surprise you sometimes, but that I just looked at a windbreak that was damaged by fire, and sometimes 10, 15 feet away, if it's hot enough, depending on which direction the wind, that heat itself can get pretty hot and cause pretty significant damage. So it is possible they could be dead, but I would give them a little time to see what happens.
Okay, Frank, thanks for your call. And next up, John in Butler County. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Yeah, the question I have, you know, a few years ago, there were Japanese beetles all over the place, chewing up everything. The last couple of years, I haven't seen any. So what's going on there?
Are you missing them, John? You're not.
Oh, yes. I had pet names for all of them.
Right. Yeah. So you don't have Japanese beetles. As an entomologist, I could say, you're welcome. But it was weather-related. We went through an explosion when the weather was very favorable for the Japanese beetle and when it was new to the state. But it was a year ago that we went through a very long, dry fall, and that stressed the Japanese beetle grubs that were in the soil. That was followed by a winter of unprecedented length of frost in the soil, and it stayed frozen for so long, and that was a double whammy that actually set the Japanese beetle population back. The good news is they're not gone forever. But the other good news is they're going to be at low levels for the next few generations, which means the next few years. But it's going to be spotty, but they didn't go away. They're not gone forever. They'll be back. They'll be around.
So the population will be cyclical.
They will bounce back, but our experience in the eastern half of the United States is it takes a few years to come back from that. But they have high reproductive potential like all insects do. They're going to make it.
All right. John, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Kathy in Ames. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question about ants in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 2 years ago, I had a huge ant mound, like sort of encompassing a sedum.
Right.
And then last year, I think I had two, and they were both on different types of sedums.
Mm-hmm.
This year, I think I have four or five, and I now have a couple of them in the lawn. And it seems like it's killing part of the sedums, and I was wondering why they're suddenly doing this, and can I do anything to prevent it?
Oh, you're just lucky. Let's start by saying ants are beneficial. They feed on seeds and other insects, and they aerate the soil, so there's a lot of good things to like about ants. When they dig around the roots of plants, they have a tendency to make the soil dry out a little bit, and some of our moisture-loving plants like sedums may suffer from the aeration of the soil. But we would like to discourage ants, but we don't want to get rid of them, and that can be done with the common garden insecticides that you buy. What I do is I rake down the ant mound that's in the lawn and I sprinkle a little insecticide on it, and then I sprinkle a little water on top of that. I've only used insecticide on that area. It's all disappeared down into the soil, knowing full well that I may have set the ants back a little bit, but I didn't eliminate them. And sometimes I have to do that twice in 1 year for an ant mound that tends to grow in the grass. When the ant mounds get up higher than the grass blades themselves, then I go out and rake them down. Left alone, in prairies and roadsides, we'll see these ant mounds reach 6 feet in diameter and 3 to 4 feet tall. So they can move a lot of soil if we let them. So we probably need to discourage them in the garden just to kind of make it easier for ourselves and to preserve the plants that they may be digging around.
All right, and make it a little more pleasant, I suppose, to work in the garden
a little bit.
All right, Kathy, thank you so much for your call. And we are out of time for today, but thank you so much, Donald Lewis.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Mark Vitosh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. We'll be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our production assistant today, Julia Davis. This is her last day with us. Thank you so much, Julia, for being a tremendous asset and a pleasure to have around the office. And good luck in all of your future endeavors. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.